from WBEZ Show. Back four. This is the story of the greatest phone message of all time. Some people see it that way anyway. You may judge for yourself. A quick warning that there is one famously nasty word in this story. It occurs exactly seven times. Seven, count them yourself. But do not worry, we beep it every single time. This American Life producer, Jonathan Goldstein, tells the tale.
The first thing you should know about my friend Josh is that he calls me a bitch squealer. Now, bitch isn't the bad word you're going to be hearing in this story. And that's because it's referring to an actual dog. A fenced-in security dog that barked at me and Josh while we were out walking one night. And while my scream may have been louder that evening, Josh's scream was definitely higher pitched, which to my mind means Josh should rightfully be called the bitch squealer, while perhaps I should be called something like bitch bellower or bitch loud crier. Just the same, quit your bitch squealing is what Josh says to me when I ask him to please change the station on the car radio, or to stop crowding the armrest in the movie theater. The other thing to know about Josh is that he thinks of himself as an idea man. And he always refers to his ideas as pure gold. So a few years ago, when I first started doing stories on the radio, I would call him up and ask him if he had any story ideas. And he always did. The thing was, most of them involved hot dog eating contests and all-nude car washes. One time Josh talked to a French-Canadian waitress who used the words diggy-doo as a conjunctive phrase, as in, my mother, she gave birth to me in Lac-Saint-Louis, and, diggy-doo, I'm in Montreal. Josh tried to convince me that this semantically innovative young woman was most definitely worthy of a 40-minute interview on national radio. Just the other day, Josh was telling me about this really funny phone message that he heard back in his college days, and how I should definitely do a radio show about that. He swore to me that it was the defining moment in his class's campus life that year. Now, how's a person supposed to believe something like that?
I mean, I can imagine you really liking this message.
Oh, I see.
But you see, I can't imagine it being the kind of thing that, you know, was
that
like...
That your sedate NPR audience would appreciate?
No. I mean, I mean, it sounds like you got a kick out of it at the time. But I mean, you know, I can't imagine it being like an atomic bomb that hit the campus or something.
Yeah. See, this is clearly another example of the failure of your imagination. How many times have I given you ideas that you have naysayed? How many times have I given you gold standard ideas?
Josh yells at me a lot, especially when he thinks I'm not taking his ideas seriously. When we go out to eat, he yells at me loud enough to make the other patrons turn around and look at us. Sometimes, though, he'll get all unexpectedly silent and just stare out the restaurant window, and then turn to me and say something like, wouldn't life be better if there was a big old pig sitting out there by the fire hydrant? Why can't life be more like that? But anyway, to get back to the phone message, the one Josh heard in college. I'm telling you about it not to demonstrate what a slightly misguided, colorful character Josh is, but to chart with honesty the unfairness of my preemptive bitch squeals of doubt.
I went to Columbia University in the early 90s, okay? Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
When I was there, they had this phone system. I'll just give you a little bit of background, all right? And then I'll cut to the chase. They had this system there called the Rome system, phone system, R-O-L-M. And you could forward messages to people, okay? You could forward messages to everyone on campus if you wanted, okay?
Sort of like a precursor to the internet.
Yes, like a precursor to the internet. Thank you, Mr. Current Affairs
guy.
All right, so it was an amazing utility. People could forward all kinds of crazy messages.
Yeah.
And so one day, there was this guy named Fred, okay?
Yeah.
And he got this message. Well, his mother left him a message on his answering machine, okay? And he forwarded it to, I don't know, maybe one or more of his friends. And his friends turned around and did a Brutus thing. They stabbed him in the back, and they forwarded this message across campus to everyone, okay? So you want to hear the message?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So he prefaced it by saying—
You have it? You have the message?
I do not have the message. I have the message in my head. I'm telling you a story, all right?
Okay.
All right. So he prefaced it by some kind of sad little lead-in. In a little voice, he was like, I think you'd appreciate hearing this message from my mother. Okay? And then the message played. This was the entirety of the message. And I'm going to do the voice for you as best I can. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, sorry. More background. He apparently had a heart. He was not a hit with the ladies, Fred. Okay, this is what I was led to understand. Okay, yeah. I'm not sure if this is true or not.
Okay.
But he had managed to score a date to go see The Little Mermaid, of all movies, okay? The Little Mermaid, okay?
Yeah.
So this is the message his own mother, okay, his blood relation, leaves for him.
Yeah.
And I quote, "You and the Little Mermaid can both go f*** yourselves. The books you wanted, they're not here. They must be in La Jolla. I'm not going to wait up all night for you. Goodbye." That's the entirety of it, all right?
Yeah. That's a message that his mother left him.
That's correct. You catch that part?
Yeah.
"You and the Little Mermaid can both go f*** yourselves. I love you, son." Okay? That's gold.
Hold on. Yeah.
Then, are you going to listen?
Yes.
All right. Then somebody took it. I don't know. Some evil Mixmeister genius took it and remixed it into a 12-inch dance version. All right? You know, "You and the Little Mermaid, La Jolla, La Jolla, f*** yourself, they're not here, the book, goodbye.
And there's other people who remember it.
Are you even listening to a word I just told you? This was the producers of its day, okay? It was, everyone heard about it, everyone knew it, everyone had an opinion about it. Every single person who attended Columbia that year would, I guarantee you, they would know what I'm talking about.
I still didn't believe him. But just for the hell of it, I phoned the Columbia Alumni Magazine to see if there was anyone there who might remember anything about the Little Mermaid message. I ended up speaking to someone who not only attended Columbia in the early 90s and remembered the message, but just like Josh had, he actually quoted it to me. The whole message. "You and the Little Mermaid can both go f*** yourselves. I can't find the books. They must be in La Jolla. I'm not going to wait up all night for you. Goodbye." The guy then became so excited at the thought of someone doing serious research about the message that he offered to use the Columbia database to look up every Fred that might have graduated around that time. No matter how long it took, he said, it'd be worth it if I could track down some recording of the message and allow him to hear it again. I called other Columbia students from that period, and every one of them reacted the same way to the message. Like this guy, Ben Feldman, now an entertainment lawyer.
Hello?
Is this Ben?
Yes.
I have two words for you. Little Mermaid.
This is the funniest call I've ever received. Well, you and the Little Mermaid can go to hell!
A few days later, Josh called me back. He'd found out Fred's last name from his older brother, who it turns out graduated the same year as Fred. Josh said that Fred's last name was Schultz, and I told Josh that this was great news, and Josh told me to shut my squeal hole, which I did. So I called Fred Schultz, and it turns out that he had recorded the original message and still had a copy of it, a copy which I am now going to play for you. Remember, this is a phone message that was forwarded from one person to the next, each person re-prefacing the previous prefaces as it made its way from one voicemail message box to the next.
"Received at 4:20 p.m. Friday.
Dad, I have never heard a phone mail message like this one. Listen to the first person. You are going to die.
Seriously, this is the funniest one of all of them.
All right, here it is."
These giddy introductory messages continue for 2.5 minutes. Each one revving up the impending drama, acting as a kind of stage curtain that opens onto another curtain, and yet another one still, each one teasing you with the tantalizing proximity of the main stage about to be bathed in the spotlight.
"Okay, I've gotten like 95 phone messages in the last 2 days, but this is the funniest.
This is going to blow you away. This makes the other ones look like chopped liver."
And then finally, the chain of deferral ends with the very first forwarded student's solemn pronouncement.
There comes a time in life when we hear the greatest phone mail message of all time, and, well, here it is. You have to hear it to believe it.
Thought you'd get a kick out of this message from my mother.
"Hi, Fred, you and the Little Mermaid can go f*** yourselves. I told
told you to stay near the phone. I can't find those books. You have other books here. It must be in La Jolla. Call me back. We're not going to stay up all night for you. Goodbye.
These days, Fred Schultz lives in Venice Beach, California. He plays in a band, he skateboards, and he pretty much seems happy. When he sent me the recording of the Little Mermaid message, he also included burnt incense and a CD of his band's soundtrack for a film about cannibalism called Eat Me. Here's a clip.
Eat me! Eat me! Eat me!
Ah! Fred's the kind of guy who, when the subject gets onto future plans, will tell you he's thinking pretty seriously about moving onto a boat. When I ask him about the phone message from his mom, he says that from the moment he got it, he knew he was sitting on something big. The question then became, what was he going to do with it?
I did sit down and stress and think about it for like an hour or two. I debated whether to send the message out to anyone, and then I sat down and listened to music and just thought about it, re-listening to the message and just thinking, should I send this along or just let it die, kill it, hit erase, you know?
But Fred decided not to hit erase. And he explains his mother's cryptic message this way. He'd called looking for an old school notebook. She said she'd search for it, but only if he'd wait by the phone while she did this special favor for him. But did he stay by the phone? No, he did not. As for the Little Mermaid, this was the one thing Josh was completely wrong about.
My whole life I have had a thing about mermaids. And dolphins, but mermaids.
When you love mermaids that much, and dolphins, you don't keep that to yourself.
My outgoing message. First it had Ariel from The Little Mermaid singing Part of Your World, singing, you know, like, Part of your world, what would I give if I could live out of these waters? And then I jump on and say, hi, please leave a message for me in The Little Mermaid. And then you hear beep.
Now put yourself in his mother's shoes. To hear Joan Schultz, Fred's mom, tell the story, that outgoing message was like a call to arms.
I hear the Little Mermaid music, and he said, sorry, I can't answer you now. Please leave a message for me and the Little Mermaid. Well, that's all I had to hear. I was so infuriated and so incensed that without even thinking, and I never, ever say this word, I said, Fred, you and the Little Mermaid can both go f*** yourselves, and I slammed the phone down.
So late that night, studying in his dorm room for finals, Fred finally decides to forward the message to his friend Jeff. Then Fred goes to bed, and by the next morning, he wakes up to discover that just like one of those guys in one of those movies, his life has suddenly become forever changed.
My message machine was blinking that all 10 messages that it accepts are filled, and they were all filled with people, like chains of like 20, it had already gone around to say each chain had hit 20 or 30 people.
Like how many people heard it over the course of the night?
Hundreds had already heard it in the middle of the night.
Over the course of how many hours?
Like 4 hours.
What was then to follow for the Schultzes was nothing short of campus-wide celebrityhood. Women ran up to Fred and hugged him. Men envied him for his ability to inspire that much raw, transparent hostility in his mother. The phone message was so popular that, like a hit TV show, it spawned spin-offs. Other messages circulated with people commenting on the original.
As a history major, I think we've got to put this into a class struggle perspective. His mother represents...
Well, from a political science standpoint, I would say that both Fred and his mother are products of the political system.
I feel that Mrs. Schultz's sexual desire for her son Fred is manifest.
And Josh was even right about the dance remix version of the message. Although no official at Columbia could confirm this next claim, virtually everyone I spoke to who graduated Fred's year remembers this as a point of fact. The popularity of The Little Mermaid yielded message threads that were too long for the new voicemail technology to handle, and so the messaging service for the whole of Columbia crashed. It goes further still. Fred's mother's message went on to become the most crowd-pleasing musical number from the year-end varsity show, a time-honored all-male production that goes back to Columbia alumni Rodgers and Hammerstein in the early 1900s. The choreographed routine involved a kick line of hairy-legged men in seashell brassieres and mermaid tails. Steve Nadick, the show's lyricist, dug out the words and favored me with a few select lines.
Oh, here it is. Look at that. But I don't even know if this is the final version because I see some handwritten notes on the side. It It starts off, we beautiful creatures inhabit the sea, fish women frolicking frivolously. Although no one said that we'd have to enjoy ya, it still could be worse. We might be in La Jolla. And then we sang In La Jolla as Handel's Messiah. So it's time to decide what you might want to do. We're not going to wait up all night for you. Goodbye.
As even the most casual viewer of VH1's Behind the Music knows, fame like this doesn't come without a price. When Fred's mother came to New York for her son's graduation, she experienced the darker side of superstardom.
On Broadway, in restaurants, in the shops there, they would say things like, "That's Fred's mother, that's the Little Mermaid." And I was mortified. Wherever we were, people would point and laugh and snicker.
So she just made it her job at that point to just walk up to any random group of people and just start saying, "You don't understand, I never used the F word. He provoked me, he provoked me." So she felt that that was her, you know, responsibility to clear her name, to at least let them know she never curses.
Before my message came along, the funniest message they had sent around was something like other kids' mothers begging them not to forget to use their rubbers in the rainy season.
Here's an example of what Joan Schultz is talking about, one of those feel-good homesy messages. This is a message from Huey Hockman's grandparents, making sure he was taking care of his cold.
"Huey, we heard you have a cold, darling. We called to see how you feel.
Yeah.
And to tell you we love you.
Yeah.
That's all. We hope you're okay, darling.
Yeah. Me too.
Good night.
Good night."
Mine was so far and above that they won't even go back to the old one.
Do you take a certain level of pride in that?
I guess so. In a strange way, yes.
The Little Mermaid message was everything Josh said that it was. And now that I spoke with everyone about its glory, there was really only one more person left to talk to.
What do you want?
I made some calls to Columbia. I spoke to some people who went to school the same time that you did. And
yeah.
Yes, I did. And diggy-doo, you were right. It was all true. The message made a great impact.
Wow. Thanks, John. Listen, what a bastard you are. I gave you gold. Don't you understand?
But anyway, you're missing the point that I'm saying I apologize because you were right.
I diggy don't give a rat's ass.
I'm going to read to you a piece of the script that I've written that I'm thinking I might actually end this whole story with, okay? Because I want to get some of your feedback, okay?
Oh, I'm ready.
I would say something to the effect of, "And so a recording intended for one person unintentionally became the beloved property of thousands. And in so happening, the message went from being what might have been considered a rather tragic personal artifact that spoke of dysfunction to becoming a triumph of contemporary American humor."
What is that? That's public radio wussy talk. Be a man.
No, a part of that whole statement is that I'm actually saying to you, you were right and I was wrong.
All right, whatever. If you want to talk that fancy talk, you do your thing, all right? But don't drag me into your serious voice nonsense. And you get to speak in this stentorian tone, like, "And then America laughed at this inadvertent piece of comedy. I'm John Goldstein."
Jonathan Goldstein has put his bitch squeals to paper in the novel Lenny Bruce is Dead. Special thanks today to Jonathan Liss, Nick Garcia, and Sonny Nieder. Musical help from Adam the Tape Guy Jacobs and from Edward Lifson. This American Life is distributed by Public Radio International. Funding for our show has been provided by the Capital Group Companies, investing for individuals and institutions throughout the world, and sponsor of the American Funds Group of Mutual Funds, WBEZ Management Oversight by Tori Malatia, who keeps showing up at my house dressed as a pizza, saying,
"Eat me, eat me, eat me!"
I'm Ira Glass, back next week with more stories of This American Life.
PRI, Public Radio International.